Welcome to VoxLab, the podcast series of Precision Talks, and listen to the voices of the scientists working towards precision toxicology to better protect human health and the environment.
Welcome to the second episode of VoxLab, the podcast by Precision Talks, a European project aiming to advance toxicology without the use of animal testing. I'm today with Jonathan Friedman, PhD in molecular pharmacology from the School of Medicine of the University of Louisville in the US at the Department of Toxicology and Pharmacology. Hello, Jonathan. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Can you tell us what is your field of research exactly? What have you been working on during your career as a scientist so far?
So my career has kind of evolved over time. So I received my PhD actually in biophysics, looking at the structure of metalloproteins. I then moved on to looking at how copper, the relationship between copper and Wilson's disease. So I became a cell biologist. I then moved into molecular biology, where I began using C. elegans as a model organism. Once I moved over to the National Institutes of Environmental Health Science, I was exposed to risk assessment, and I worked with the National Toxicology Program. So I became somewhat immersed in toxicology, what's the traditional toxicology. But throughout my career, my focus has actually been on metals. So I worked with copper early on. I now focus on cadmium toxicology, looking at everything from how cadmium affects gene expression, contributes to cancer formation, all the way up to risk assessment, how cancer affects populations. As part of this, I also began a work when I was at Duke and then moved over to the NIH to begin using C. elegans as a model test organism for toxicology. And this is where we can talk about how toxicology in the United States has evolved. So I'm not sure the years, probably in the 2000s, the National Academy of Science published a monograph talking about, basically saying how toxicology needed to evolve from a observational science, what we used to jokingly refer to as shoot 'em and kill 'em science. You inject a chemical into a rat, then kill it and see what it does, to a more mechanistic based science where expose an organism to a chemical and look at the molecular level, look at the mechanisms to see what the chemical is doing, not just observational, but mechanistic science. And as part of this, Chris Pardier, who's actually part of Precision Tox, who at that time was head of the National Toxicology Program, approached me and basically said, can we use C. elegans as a toxicologic model and develop high throughput screening methods for using this organism? And I said, sure, we can do it. So we received funding from the National Toxicology Program, and we developed high throughput methods for toxicity testing using C. elegans. We started it at Duke, and then I moved the entire project to the National Toxicology Program at NIH.
So you're using C. elegans. It's a nematode, a worm, that we can find almost everywhere, basically everywhere in the...
Correct. You can go into your garden and dig up some soil and find the worms in there. It's actually, I trained high school students in how to do this. So they would go to their backyards, compost heaps. It's basically using a nylon stocking and a funnel and some water, and you put it in there and the worms just flow out the bottom, and you can look at them under the microscope. And the kids isolated hundreds of different types of microscopic worms. And C. elegans was unique in that it was actually Sidney Brenner, who was at the MRC at the time, and he proposed to find an organism and learn everything you can about it. And that's kind of been the underlying philosophy of C. elegans research. And people can actually, in the earlier days, people could actually trace their lineage to Sidney Brenner. So Sidney had a group of about seven or nine postdoctoral fellows they scattered throughout the world. One of his fellows, a guy named Dave Hall, ended up at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And I was at school at the same time, and Dave was promoting CL GANs. So Sidney actually referred to me as one of his bastard children, because I didn't come directly from his lab, but I came from the lab associated with one of his students or one of his postdocs. And you used to go to the meetings and you'd see these lineage, huge lineage posters where everyone could trace themselves back to Sidney one way or the other. And in using that type of philosophy, it's people have just done everything they can with the worm. We'll talk about this in a little bit. It's a very easy organism to work with. So if you have an idea and say, well, let's just try this. I mean, it's basically a week's worth of work, maybe $10 or $15 US cost. And you may find something truly novel and original. So that's what we did. My background has always been in metal toxicology and mechanisms of metal, how metals affect organisms to lead to diseases. I've personally looked at cancer. I'm now interested in autism spectrum disorder, male infertility, all associated with exposure to cadmium and environmental metals.
And you can learn from the worm. You can study those diseases and conditions.
Well, I actually have multiple projects. So the male infertility, that was actually done in mice. So my research is focused on cadmium toxicology. So I use C. elegans, I use yeast, I use mice, I use mammalian cell culture. Every system has advantages. And that's kind of one of the, you know, tenets of precision tox, is that every organism has an advantage, but not every organism can answer every question. And historically, people have felt that, you know, mice and rats, because they're vertebrates, they're warm and fuzzy. We're all aware of Mickey Mouse, you know, an anthropomorphized mouse, and we have anthropomorphized rats, that a rat behaves just like a human. And it's not true. A fruit fly is as much a human as a mouse is a human. A nematode is as human as much as a rat is a human. Each model organism has strengths and weaknesses. And that's kind of what we've been fighting about, at least, or trying to champion, that these alternative species are as valid as the warm, fuzzy vertebrate species. And that has been a big fight since I've started in this field. You know, trying to convince people that nematodes are as good as any other organism to study different problems.
We learned with 3D McKay during the first podcast that Drosophila, for instance, shares 60% of their genetic ancestry with humans. Is that the same with nematodes? Can you tell us more about this small organism, their size, their lifespan, how they reproduce?
Sure. So C. elegans comes in, jokingly referred to as 1.5 sexes. There are self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, which are generally about 98% of a population. Then about 2% are males. So the males produce sperm and they fertilize the hermaphrodites. So that actually allows you to do classic genetics. So you can take a male of one gene background and a hermaphrodite of another gene background and do classic male-female crosses. The nematodes are very easy to work with. The adult is about 1 millimeter in length. Because they're self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, you can take a single hermaphrodite, put it on a petri dish with food, and they eat E. coli or bacteria as their food. And within, you know, 4 or 5 days, you'll have 400 self-fertilizing hermaphrodites. Another 3 or 4 days, I mean, you can do the math. Each organism produces about 400 offspring. So, and they're very easy to maintain. I'd say they're as easy as growing bacteria in a lab. You use microscopes, dissecting microscopes to see them. One interesting fact is that they're transparent, so you can actually look at them under the microscope and watch cells divide. There's some really great papers from the MRC on the early days where a scientist sat under a microscope for several days and he watched a single embryo grow. So he actually mapped where every cell came from. So you can look at a cell and go, okay, this cell came from these parents. So you can look to see, as a model for cell biology, when this program is disrupted, you can see, look to see what caused it. A hermaphrodite has, 959 cells plus oocytes and sperm. And that's pretty invariant. So each nematode is a genetic copy of a previous nematode. Like I said, working with them in the lab, you pick them up with toothpicks. They're non-parasitic. They grow at room temperature. So they're a great tool for experienced scientists and for, like I said, I've trained high school students to use them, and they grew them in the lab. So there are 3 Nobel Prizes associated with C. elegans, which makes it much cooler than Drosophila. I think the first Nobel, because apoptosis, which we now know in humans is a very important process in development, was first discovered in C. elegans. RNA interference was discovered by Andy Fire in C. elegans. It is now used in medical treatment and, you know, used in addressing human conditions, and using green fluorescent protein as a marker to identify cells and gene expression, and hundreds of different applications, which was originally discovered or examined in C. elegans. So each of those things led to a C. elegans researcher and associates receiving the Nobel.
If I remember, if I'm correct, C. elegans was also one of the first organisms whose DNA was sequenced. Am I correct?
That's correct. Yes, C. elegans was the first organism to have its genome completely sequenced. And a lot of the tools that were developed based on the C. elegans genome project were applied to the human projects and other organisms. And this was when sequencing was done pseudo-manually. We didn't have RNA-seq or any of these high-tech type of procedures. It was done with sequencing gels and dyes. And it was really great. I was in the C. elegans community when this was going on. It was just very exciting to hear, you know, we've sequenced this. And we had genetic maps. So C. elegans have been a genetic organism since its inception. And now we were able to link genetic phenotypes to actual physical genes, which was really good, because you can now see what are the functions of specific physical genes in determining growth, reproduction, cancer formation. And it's interesting, and it's one of the things we have to battle about, is that C. elegans is a great model for many human conditions. So the RAS signaling pathway were discovered in C. elegans and Drosophila, even though, which is related to cancer, but C. elegans doesn't get cancer. But what it has is a multicellular phenotype. It's multiple vulva from the animal, which is the equivalent of a cancer in this RAS pathway. So C. elegans has been used for polycystic kidney disease, cancer, a lot of neurologic diseases. C. elegans nervous system has been completely mapped. So we can look to see where neurons go, what they innervate. We can use lasers to knock them out and see what the consequences are. So C. elegans has been used for neurodevelopmental biology. It's been used, big pharma has tried to use it for their studies, that you can put the genes in C. elegans that cause plaques associated with Alzheimer's. So people would take these plaque-producing C. elegans and then treat it with drugs that they hoped would alleviate these Alzheimer plaques and look to see what happens. You can do the same thing with Huntington's protein. You can look to see what can we actually play with that a little bit. You take the worms and you attach the Huntington's protein to green fluorescent protein, so you can see these bundles. And then you treat the animal with drugs and see if the bundles go away. Just look at it under a microscope. And if the drug makes the bundles go away, you have a candidate to look in higher organisms. Again, this is very fast. You can look at 100 drugs in a couple of weeks. But people will argue, well, how can you look at cancer and C. elegans if they don't get cancer? Well, you know, and this gets to the foundation of precision tox, is that a lot of the genes and a lot of the pathways are conserved. So even if the phenotype is different, so if C. elegans has genes that make cancer and humans have the same genes and mutating them in C. elegans causes multiple cells, you can look at that mechanism and that pathway, because humans will have a similar, in some cases, identical process. And it's much easier to work in worms and Drosophila and these simple organisms. And the NIH has recognized this, so they actually have a list of biomedical alternative species and includes C. elegans, Daphnia, Drosophila, Xenopus, a lot of these other organisms. So, yeah.
As you mentioned, Precision Tox is using C. elegans, Drosophila, Xenopus as well, the organism that you just mentioned, and is funded by the European Union. It's a 5-year project during which you will test these different animal models, organism models, and compare with human cell lines. How many chemicals will you test during this project, and what are the results that you expect with C. elegans in particular? What will be the endpoint that you will be studying in this project?
So there's multiple endpoints. So I'm actually involved at the earlier stages. So I have a lot of experience in developing high throughput methods using alternative species. So we, in C. elegans, we can test probably, what was it, like 20 or 30 chemicals a month, which based on cells, that's trivial. But if you look at, compared to rats, we're like ultra high throughput. So, and in doing that, we've gone through all of, since we were the first group to do this, we've identified a lot of the pitfalls that you can have. So we developed the methods, so the actual machinery and logistics on how to test the worms, but more importantly, we worked with some very good statisticians on how to analyze the data. And we discovered things that people didn't realize were problems very early on. At one point, one of our statisticians said, statistics is not designed for high throughput. Classic statistics takes a small sample of a population. If you're doing classic studies, you're looking at maybe 100 rats or something like that. And your statistics is based on that number. When we're working with elegans, we're looking at thousands of animals per condition. And statistics is such that very small variations become significant. So we actually, in our early days, we actually discovered that the changing the air pressure in the building, which is attached to one of our machines, causes a statistically significant variation in our data. Getting back to your question about what is C. elegans going to bring to precision tox, we have the early how to do toxicologic studies using these organisms. But like all of the other test species, there's a huge genomic database. So we can, what we'll bring is all of the genomic data. So elegans would be an excellent organism to contribute to the metabolomic database and the transcriptomic database as part of this whole phylotox project. So to get to your other question of how many chemicals are we going to test, Precision Tox is proposing to test 250 chemicals. And that number is based primarily on budget. One of the things I'm also familiar with is how expensive it is to build a chemical library. People think you know, I will get a chemical library. They don't realize that the purchasing the chemicals can be expensive. Quality control in Tox 21, they would actually buy a chemical, and there were several cases where the chemical that was in the bottle was not the same as the chemical label. You know, there's also a very relatively famous story about the EPA was testing a chemical and they got this really robust response. And that went contrary to what other people were finding. And they found that there was like less than a percent contaminant. And this contaminant was hugely biologically active. So, I mean, just these are the problems that we have. How do we choose the chemicals? So we've broken it up into four groups. So there's group one, which is the first five chemicals. These are chemicals that we're very familiar with in terms of toxicology. These are a pilot group. So because most of the investigators in precision tox aren't familiar with doing this type of work, we've chosen these so we can work out issues of logistics. So how do you ship a chemical internationally? You know, there's...
Yes, we have to remind that there are 15 organizations in 8 different countries in the US and in Europe in this project for the people who are listening right. to that.
And each organization will have its own requirements for receiving toxic chemicals. So, you know, so how do you purchase them? How do you distribute them? How do you do the exposures? You know, for each organism has its different exposures. How are we going to determine what's toxic? Where, you know, so it's developing all these logistics. And then once we get the toxicology data, then we will generate material for the omics analysis. So then when you go, so the omics groups have to work out their issues. For example, metabolomics is still trying to determine how much biologic material they need for their studies. And then you have the data analysis group. And they'll look at the data and they'll go, okay, this data is bad, this data is good. We have to modify the procedure. So the way we're doing the exposures for the pilot is 2 different concentrations, I think 4 or 5 time points, which is something we can do for the first 5. We can't do it for the next, you know, 245. It's just you don't have enough time and or money. So then the data analysis group will come back and say, okay, don't use this set of time points. Use this concentration, not that concentration. So they'll feed back to us and tell us how to design the experiment for the next group. And then second group are 50 chemicals, which we've selected. And these are chemicals that we have a lot of toxicologic data on in multiple species in humans. We know the molecular initiating events, what triggers the toxic response. We know some adverse outcome pathway data. So this is to test the concept of precision tox, which is the follow tox model. And what we'd expect to see is that some of the organisms would be affected by all the chemicals. For example, cadmium and arsenic will probably affect everything up through the evolutionary tree. Then we'll have some chemicals which will not affect nematodes or Drosophila because they lack a receptor or they lack an organ to be targeted, but will affect the vertebrate models. And likewise, we'll have chemicals that will affect the invertebrate models that won't affect the vertebrate models. So we have some helminthicides, you know, nematode toxins. So we expect them to kill nematodes at very low doses and may not have any effect in zebrafish. The next group is 150 chemicals, and that will be some data rich, some unknowns, again, to kind of flush out, to create these adverse outcome pathways, further develop biomarkers of toxicity. All of these with the idea that, you know, if we look at molecular and biochemical, so transcriptomic and metabolomic responses, we'll be able to predict in humans. You know, we'll see evolutionary conservation, and what we see in these organisms is subcellular level, we'll be able to predict what happens in humans. The last chemicals are 50, and these are set aside for case studies. You're familiar with ASPIS.
ASPIS is a cluster of project with the Precision Talks, this project, but also OnTox and RiskCenter, two other European projects funded under the same call to advance toxicology assessment of chemicals without the use of mammalian testing. So there is a cluster in place so that the three projects can collaborate to validate at the end of the 5 years project some methods to replace mammalian testing.
So Precision Tox is very molecular focused. So like I said, transcriptomics and metabolomics. OnTox is very organ focused. So it's kind of like up the complex biological complexity. Then RiskCenter is very human focused. So they're doing risk assessment, things like that. So you have this nice continuum that we're going to build on. So we actually had a meeting yesterday morning, and we are coming up with ASPIS-wide projects. So the last 50 chemicals we will set aside for ASPIS-wide projects. Case studies, there are several case studies have been proposed by different groups. All this to fall into the Precision Talks to get it more accepted by risk assessors and things like that, because and we can talk about this again. One of the issues that we have to deal with Precision Talks and the fact that the EU finally funded this type of research is a step in the right direction. But I've been doing this for 20 plus years, and you know, trying to convince people who do risk assessments in humans that the response you see in C. elegans or Drosophila is relevant to humans is a real battle. So the results that we get from Precision Talks in all of our model organisms will help, you know, in that battle.
Yes, because the methods need to be validated on international level so that they are accepted by regulators and risk assessors as a relevant model for toxicology testing. So this is always a long process.
One of the interesting things with Europe versus the United States is that what the EU has done is they have said, you have to test these chemicals. So they have the REACH program. And then they say, oh, and you can't use mammalian organisms to do it. So they have forced the issue that says, you now have to use these alternative methods and you have to accept them. I mean, inevitably, if you can't test in animals and you can only test in C. elegans and the Precision Tox models and other and cells, and you have to begin accepting this data. I mean, you have no choice. You have to have, you know, portfolios and toxicologic information on all of these chemicals, and these are the only ways you can do it. So there's this background push that says you need to begin considering acceptance of alternative models. The United States, on the other hand, does not have that in place. They still do animal studies. I've been in meetings with people from the Chemical Research Chemical Council, and their comment is, the government says we don't have to do it, we're not gonna do it. When the government says you have to test in C. elegans and Drosophila and do all these other model organisms, that's when we'll do that. Until then, we don't care. And there's some real pushback in the risk assessment community on using these models because of what I've previously said. Like, it's not warm and fuzzy. It doesn't have legs. It doesn't look like, it's not a vertebrate. So, and it's traditions. I mean, it's been that way for, I don't know, 50, 70 years of risk based on using mammalian organisms. And it's just very difficult to change people's minds.
But this is the entire objective of this project.
Exactly. Well, at the front end, we're going to generate all this tox data and show how it can be extrapolated to human conditions. And other work packages in Precision Tox are going to get out there and interact with the risk assessors and say, this works, and this is how you have to start using it. And like I said, a lot of the people in the EU, the higher ups in the risk assessment community, support this type of research. In the United States, I think they're going to wait and see. Every time I've been contacted to use CLGANs as a toxicologic model, I've been contacted multiple times over the years from different companies. They've almost always been EU-based countries, companies.
So PrecisionTox is advancing alternative methods to replace mammalian testing. What is the impact for the society, the fact that we no longer, in the future, hopefully, no longer use mammalian models that are long and maybe less accurate? What would be the benefit for society, for human and the environment of this project?
So one of the problems that has faced toxicology and which advanced the idea of looking at mechanisms is the amount of chemicals in the environment. Depending on who you talk to, there's anywhere between 5,000 and 20,000 chemicals that need to be tested. And these are things produced by industry, pharmaceuticals, just human production chemicals. If you add in the non-anthropomorphic chemicals, like just the things that you find in the environment, metals in soil, things like that, this number can grow. And then if you include mixtures, which is something that toxicologists have been talking about for decades, but no one has really found the good, I shouldn't say no one has really found because I pissed someone off, but it's been a very difficult problem to address. And they're still trying to address it. One of the proposals we've gotten for a case study is to do mixtures. So basically there is a lot of chemicals out there that need to be tested. And it's financially impossible to test them in rodents. An average mouse or rat study can cost anywhere between $3 and $5 million per chemical. So if you're doing long-term studies, you're looking at anywhere from 6 months to 5 years per chemical. And if you're just doing classic toxicology, you're probably not going to get all of the endpoints that you want to look for, development, endocrine disruption, things like that. So this requires an alternative pathway. So with C. elegans, we did 1,000 chemicals a year in our high throughput screen. And that was just, three people. And if you maximize it, you can imagine how high throughput we can become. And the same thing with these other organisms. So to address the issue of having all of these chemicals into the environment, and again, that doesn't even include the ones that are being developed and that big pharma and ag chem have in their queue, you can see that it's a formidable project to test all these chemicals. So this requires a new method for testing, something that you can screen all these chemicals quickly and cheaply. So a C. elegans study, independent of people's salary, costs a few dollars per chemical. So now if you move to PrecisionTox model, where now we can test large numbers of chemicals quickly, and we can do that simultaneously. So we can test, let's say, 50 chemicals at a time, going from the toxicologic studies in the different model organisms through the omics data collection and analysis. And we're developing machine learning techniques to be able to predict what happens in humans. Now these, thousands of chemicals that need to be tested can actually be tested quite quickly and inexpensively. And new chemicals that come on, we can do some early tests and see, well, this chemical behaves exactly like this other one, so we would predict that it's going to have the same disease outcome. Keep in mind, there's this view that all chemicals are bad. That's not true. Most chemicals are innocuous. I mean, certainly there's the law, the classic toxicologic parameter that every chemical is toxic at some dose holds true. mean, even water will kill you at a high enough dose. But within what the realm of human exposures, if we can test in these systems, we can go through and determine what's safe and what needs to be watched quite quickly and inexpensively. And we can look to see what diseases we should look for if we have a chemical that triggers a certain disease pathway. Always at the end, humans are not the same as all of our model organisms. So we're making predictions. And it's the predictions that we can determine what we should watch out for. And at the end of the day, most of these things are limited by financial resources. You know, we don't have enough people to watch or do epidemiology on every chemical that's out there. But if we can use precision talks to say, these are the things we should focus on. Funny looking microscopic organisms, the implications for global human health is massive.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for taking this time to answer my question.
Thank you, Jenna. It was a pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to hearing the podcast.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To learn more about precision toxicology and listen to the new episodes of VoxLab, visit our website, precisiontox.org, and follow us on Twitter at precisiontox. This project has received the financial support of the European Union's Horizon 2020 program. The content of this program only reflects the author's view. The EU cannot be held responsible for any information contained therein.